Hello and welcome to New Books in African Studies. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. Every week we look at a new book connected with Africa that is particularly interesting and interview the author. In this programme, I'm talking to James Brabazon, the author of My Friend the Mercenary, a remarkable book that is part memoir, part story of a journalist and part account of first a civil war and then a failed coup. The African backdrop takes us from Liberia to Equatorial Guinea to South Africa and many points in between, and the book is a cracking read. I hope you enjoy the interview. With me here opposite a table in the spring sunshine in an office high above Westminster in London is James Brabazon, the author of My Friend the Mercenary. And it's a strange book because it combines several things. It's a memoir, it's a book about journalism. It's a book about a very, very strange relationship which led to James almost getting involved in a coup. And the second part of the book is all about that and the coup in Equatorial Guinea a few years ago. You may remember the headlines. But anyway, welcome, James.
Thanks very much. It's always good to start off with a description of my book as strange. Maybe we can have a drop quote for the cover. strange book.
Strange, but very, very, very interesting. You know, it's a story that I know fairly well because I know you from several places in the past. But it's very, very well known and it's a cracking story. But let's start off, because it's a memoir, with a little bit more about you, you know, where you come from and ultimately what led you to be in the situation to write this book.
Yeah, it is fun. It is a memoir. Fundamentally, the book is a story about friendship. It's about friendship in Africa under extremely difficult conditions. And you know, a lot of the book is devoted to, you know, African international current affairs. So we, you know, it dwells a lot on the Liberian Civil War, 2002, 2003, the Equatorial Guinea coup plot. But what I wanted to do was achieve something which is fundamentally different to just committing a straightforward act of journalism. I wanted to write something that people who weren't actually interested necessarily in the nitty-gritty of current affairs would find compelling and motivating. So I wrote it as a memoir. And essentially what the book describes is my relationship with a South African mercenary called Nick Du Toit. And it's, you know, the origins of my friendship with him, how it developed, and fundamentally what the consequences of that relationship were, both for him and for me. And I wanted to write about friendship in war, because this really is, you know, most of this book is set one way or another at war, or in the aspiration of going to war, or in the aftermath of war. I wanted to write about friendship in war because, you know, it's very, you know, having spent a long time on front lines, a long time in very active combat, seeing close quarter combat, filming it, photographing it, writing about it. It's actually incredibly exclusive. It's a very difficult thing to convey to someone really who hasn't been there. However successfully one thinks one's doing it, it's actually fundamentally alien. It's not normal to have someone to point a gun at you and try and kill you. And trying to explain what that's like is very difficult at times. And I wanted to kind of concentrate on my friendship with this South African mercenary, because with Nick, because actually pretty much everyone has a best friend. And pretty much everyone's best friend at some time or another is going to have asked them to do something that they'd rather not do, or they knew they shouldn't do, but they'll do it anyway because they're friends. And I think that's something that's universal, that's enduring. So however difficult some of the circumstances are that I'm writing about to understand, perhaps, in terms of, you know, what it's like to witness the mechanics of an execution or torture, everyone understands that the parameters of friendship. And what I'm doing is essentially showing them under a very extreme condition.
And you spoke then about the photography, the filmmaking, the other bits of journalism that you've done and that led to this, to all of these experiences in My Friend the Mercenary. Just go back a bit and tell me how you got involved in this world of covering wars in bad bits of Africa.
Yeah, I'd say wars are bad, and they make bits of places bad. I wouldn't say that there are inherently bad bits of Africa. Africa is afflicted by conflict in the way that other places are.
Bit of
are.
Journalism shorthand. Yes. Bad bits of Africa. It's a bit like the yeah. Dark Continent or something. Excuse me for using yeah. that. Anyway,
but what I would say is that I'm a television director and producer. So I make films for British television and for US television, and I film, produce and direct them. That's what I do for a living now. And what this book really charts is my journey into that career and some of the people that I met along the way. When I was first starting out, I was a stills photographer and shot reportage photographs. I was trying to make my name as a reportage photographer, and not terribly successfully, I hasten to add. And I came across a story in West Africa, in Liberia. I'd been photographing at the very end of the Civil War in Sierra Leone in 2001. And I met there some of the South African mercenaries who'd fought for the Executive Outcomes Private Army during the mid-90s in Sierra Leone, who'd then settled there subsequently. And I met some of them and stayed in touch with them. And one guy in particular, a guy called Cobus, he began telling me stories about another civil war that was going on in Liberia, that a group of rebels were trying to overthrow the then president, Charles Taylor. But it was a war that was entirely unreported. No one had accessed the rebel side. Very serious commentators disputed that it was happening at all. And there was almost no information about it. But Cobus was adamant that this fighting was taking place, quite large pitch battles. And at that time, Sierra Leone had the largest deployment of United Nations peacekeepers on Earth, about 17,500 air-supported combat troops in Sierra Leone. And these were battles which were allegedly taking place not more than 100 miles away from them, and yet no one knew anything about it, nor was anyone doing anything to intervene in it. And the reason that I found what I was being told credible was because Cobus, as well as being a former mercenary, had also undertaken contracts on behalf of the US government, the US military, in West Africa, in Liberia, for embassy evacuations and that kind of thing. And he was very clear that actually US intelligence were working very closely with the rebels, and he believed that both US intelligence and the rebels would be interested in some kind of media representation. And that's how this story really began. It was a sort of an extraordinary scoop. No one seems to know anything about. So I began negotiating with Cobus. I wrote, long formal letters of introduction to the rebel leadership to kind of press my case for going to meet them. These letters were then handed over to the rebels, and eventually they agreed and invited me in with the backing of US intelligence. And Cobus made it very clear to me that I was suggesting going into an environment that was an active war zone, be completely cut off from the outside world. There was no communications infrastructure at all. Very little was known about the terrain, the logistics, and I would be operating, if I was meeting the rebels in rebel-held Liberia, in the north of the country, perhaps several hundred miles over the border and beyond the reach of anyone who might reasonably be expected to come and get me if there was a problem. So he suggested that I take a security advisor with me, a bodyguard, if you like, and said he had just the man for the job, which was the South African mercenary Nick Du Toit. And Nick had been a colonel in South Africa's apartheid-era army. He'd been a special forces operator and had been the founding father of a specific special forces group called Five Reconnaissance, Five Recce. And Five Recce's exploits across southern Africa essentially the mid-1970s through to the early 1990s were infamous, and as they were shadowy. Essentially, the sort of Five Recce was the South African apartheid state equivalent of the SAS, But they were not fundamentally accountable to a democratically elected government, really quite the opposite.
Can I jump in there and just say, obviously, you're dealing with people like Kobus, and he's introducing you to people like Nick, and you know the background of these people. How does that make you feel? Does it make you feel as though you're having to be severely compromised? Is it just a bit of background that you just dismiss and say, right, let's concentrate on the present?
Well, it's interesting, you see, because rather naively, when I first met Nick, I didn't know who he was at all. I was introduced to someone.
So Kobus hadn't told you exactly the background of this
guy?
No, not at all.
No, I was told he was a very experienced soldier and he was just the guy I needed. I didn't know anything about his background or any details about him. Nick is an intensely, ironically, an intensely personal and private man. So although he has really embraced the idea of having a book written about him, but subsequently, now his life is somewhat different. I just knew I was meeting someone experienced who would look after me. And in the meeting, it became clear that Nick had been Kobus's senior officer in executive outcomes in Sierra Leone in the mid-90s. And in fact, Nick had been one of the sort of three senior field commanders for the whole mercenary operation. Mm-hmm. Then it came out that he was experienced in various kinds of covert and overt warfare. I didn't really know anything about the recce's. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, not many people do really know very much about what Five Recce was up to outside of a few very specialist publications. Mm-hmm. So what impressed me about Nick was that he knew the terrain, he'd worked in the region, and he was also a very experienced combat medic. And that was mm-hmm. one of his specialities. So, you know, as far as I was concerned, I was going in with someone who would run logistics for me, run a medical evacuation, and that once we were in country, he would be armed. And that he would create enough space around me so that I could get clear if I needed to, and that I would have someone watching my back while I was able to get on with the job of filming.
So,
and it became on location, it became clear quite rapidly that Nick's background was much more nuanced and complicated than I'd imagined. Initially, when I was brought up in London in the 70s, you know, the default position, both at home and at school, was that, the ANC and the black liberation movements in Southern Africa were exactly that. They were liberation movements who were heroes fighting against a tyrannical enemy. And that, you know, Nazi Germany and the apartheid state in South Africa were morally equivalent.
Mm. The way through to not buying a cape. Grapes when they appeared at the greengrocers. You know,
yeah, exactly.
This was a fairly common stance.
Yeah, very common stance, right through the middle class, through the working class. I mean, everyone basically signed, apart from a few, you know, sort of crazy, conservative youth members wearing Hang Mandela T-shirts. I mean, you know, the overwhelming...
characterise anyone too harshly. But anyway, let's jump forward, because this is the first half of the book, basically. It is... I hesitate to call them adventures because they're extraordinary, they're also very, very harrowing. Some of the things that happened while you were tracking down, it's the Lurd army, they're the rebels, L-U-R-D, with Nick. And it involves, physically, it involves an enormous amount of hardship, just being able to get in country, get close to these people, follow them along. And then there's the mental and psychological side. Mm. And the two of you forge an extraordinary friendship during this.
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things happening, almost simultaneously. The first is that I went in, you know, I said I was a stills photographer, and I'd done a little bit of news production as well. But I didn't really understand what a news producer does, and I frankly still don't.
This is why you write books as well.
Exactly. I went in as a producer, you know, and I took a cameraman in with me and a sound man and Nick the bodyguard. And that was a big crew. And we had a 3-week contract. The cameraman, sound man, and Nick had 3-week contracts to go in. It was independently funded by an independent production company. And after 3 weeks, we had got very little distance inside of Liberia at all, and we hadn't really filmed anything. And the cameraman and the sound man, who were both very ill from the journey already, and their contracts had expired, left. I mean, up sticks and went. The rebels escorted them out of the country, and that was that. And they,
it was Guinea that you entered through the north, through Guinea.
That's correct, yeah. From near the border near Macenta in eastern Guinea. And as the cameraman left, he said, oh, well, here you go. And he gave me a mini DV digital video camera, box of 20 tapes, a couple of spare batteries, a charger. I said, good luck. And I'd never shot any TV pictures before.
And Nick stayed on, obviously.
Yeah. As the cameraman got to the edge of the jungle, he turned around again because he'd forgotten to give me the instruction manual. And so Nick and I sat down and read the instruction manual to the camera. Because I was used to shooting stills. I'd never done anything with audio at all. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how to shoot video. So we worked it out between us. Nick stayed on. Then the production company went bust, effectively. And I had a very awkward conversation with them where they said, well, effectively, we can't afford to keep you there. So good luck. And by the way, we can't afford to pay Nick. So then I had this sort of incredibly awkward conversation with Nick, who by this point, you know, was in full reconnaissance regiment battle dress with an AK over his knees and 300 rounds of ammunition strapped to his chest. And, you know, mercenaries are as mercenaries do, and they get paid to go to war. So there's me standing in front of him saying, oh, by the way, we don't really know each other that well. And actually, there's no money. And it was a bit of a defining
Sorry,
moment.
Were you with the rebels by this point?
Yes.
You were. Yeah. You'd made contact.
We made contact and everything. And, you know, they took us over the border in the first place.
But you were nowhere near anything could remotely be described as a front line, which is why you hadn't been able to do any filming.
Exactly. We were several days walk away from a front line. And Nick said, look, you know, he made a calculation, I think. if you don't film combat, you can't see the rebels in action. If you can't prove that these people actually pose a threat to Taylor's government, then you don't have a film. And I guess the calculation was for him that he would then never be paid. But, you know, he said, look, I'll stay on. Mm-hmm. Let's just do this for however long it takes. And rather than taking 3 weeks, it took nearly 3 months. But what happened almost immediately was that Nick got incredibly ill with dysentery. Mm-hmm. To the point where we'd lost our medical supplies on route so far. He got so ill that I thought he died. Mm-hmm. And then he revived. And I thought, God, you know, if this is flawed Nick, imagine what this would do to me.
And then you swapped places.
And we swapped places. And I could feel myself sort of beginning to disintegrate internally. And I said, you know, Nick, has this ever happened to you before? Because I'd had dysentery before, but I knew it was bad. And he said, yeah, no, the only other time it was this bad was in Zimbabwe in 1985. And I said, oh, hang on a minute, what were you doing in Zimbabwe in 1985? By which point, you know, Zimbabwe had been independent for 5 years. And he said, oh, you know, we were taking out a terrorist safe house in Harare.
For whom?
Essentially, it was part of, you know, there were a series of raids which special forces conducted on behalf of the apartheid government, the very infamous raid on Gaborone being another one, mm-hmm. raid on Harare, which Nick participated in, which essentially what he called terrorists, were what I'd grown up to call freedom fighters, in this case members of the ANC, mm-hmm. who whose bases they destroyed, operatives they killed, in the name of the apartheid state. And so as I was slipping into this sort of deep, deep traumatic illness, I sort of realised that the person with me was not just, you know, a roughy-tufty soldier, but he was a different order of soldier. He was someone who had conducted very controversial operations in defence of the apartheid state.
Can I just jump in here? I know that we need to crack on with the actual story itself, but this this group of people who used to conduct operations for the South African Special Forces, they're a very interesting group, as you say. Some of them left and formed organisations such as Executive Outcomes. They were involved elsewhere in the continent. Some of them are still living in, scattered across, and some of them are black. This is an extraordinary group of people. I mean, how did your thoughts about these people evolve, and what is the fate of some of these people? Have they gone back to post-apartheid South Africa?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of Nick specifically, I mean, my thoughts about him and his past evolved along extremely visceral personal lines. While I was recovering from dysentery, to be brutally honest, I couldn't really stand up. So every time I wanted to go to the bathroom, Nick had to haul me outside and physically hold me over the latrine. And there's a point at which when another man has held you up by your wrists while you take a shit over a ditch, you're either mates or you're not. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter what he's done. And after that, Nick and I were mates. And we spent a long time then unravelling each other's personal histories. By the time we eventually got down to the front line, and in the end, Nick and I walked well over 300 miles through primary jungle mm-hmm. In Liberia. By the time we got to the front line, we then spent around 30 days almost continuously in combat. And in the course of which he physically intervened and directly saved my life on two occasions, mm-hmm. without which I would certainly have been killed. He dragged me out of the way of the path of a rocket-propelled grenade. Mm. And while I filmed executions and torture and, you know, very close firefights in which people were being, you know, literally dropping around us, he kept me safe mm-hmm. insofar as it's possible to do in that location. And my friendship with Nick grew out of that crucible, if you like. If Nick and I met each other as, you know, in civilian life somewhere in South Africa, I doubt we'd even have had a conversation. But what happens in war, it's a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. It compresses what could take years to build up in the world, can take a matter of days or weeks to come to fruition under fire. And that's what happened to Nick and I. We were friends out of necessity, but also through surviving adversity together. Mm-hmm. And we were surviving it together as well. You know, I mean, he nearly died as well.
So came to terms with this former...
So I essentially, you know, I mean, whatever one may think about his past, whatever I thought about his past, the difference between Nick and I was that he'd fought for it. You know, it's his friends that died on the battlefield. It's his mates that got killed fighting, not mine. And I'm not South African. I don't come from that history. I have personal thoughts and feelings about it. But whatever Nick did, right or wrong, he had a right to his past and a right to come to terms with it himself without being judged by me.
Have other people in South Africa, in the Southern African nations, come to terms with people like him and his black former colleagues?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very important to an extent, you know, to an extent. I mean, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa went a long way to resolving some of those conflicts, and more, I think, than a lot of people really give credit for on a personal level. And Nick, by the way, was never called before the TRC. Mm-hmm. The thing is that, you know, it was a myth, really, that these were things which were being perpetrated only by white soldiers, because there were a lot of black African soldiers involved. And one of the sort of special groups of soldiers was the so-called Buffalo Battalion, 3-2 Battalion, who were, it's kind of like South Africa's Foreign Legion, that were made up with Angolan, Namibian black soldiers. Led by mainly white officers of Portuguese, South African, and Namibian descent. And they ended up settling back in South Africa at the end of the apartheid era, and they were sort of shunted off to an asbestos-ridden place called Pomfret in the north of South Africa, where they were pretty much abandoned by the post-apartheid government as an embarrassment. And it's out of that community of people who never found legitimate work, really, in South Africa, who were the bedrock of foot soldiers to be recruited by other mercenary armies, such as Executive Outcomes or foot soldiers for the Equatorial Guinea coup plot army. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it bears remembering that the vast majority of soldiers who fought in Executive Outcomes were black Africans. Mm-hmm. Nick's 5 Recce had a very large number of black South African troops in it. And that's actually something that's even denied or questioned even by South Africans today, but it's absolutely the case. You know, I mean, when Nick was on operations, most of the troops he was on operations with were black Africans. And it's Nick's opinion, slightly controversially, that actually, in many ways, the South African army really set the agenda and led the pace for integration in South Africa, because apartheid was dismantled in the army much faster than it was anywhere else in South African society. And the army's model came from special forces, where it was dismantled almost immediately. There in fact, wasn't an operational system of apartheid in South African special forces on a social or operational level.
Mm-hmm. To go back to one of the other characters that we've mentioned, there's Cobus Claessens. Mm. As you know, I met Cobus when I was in Sierra Leone. Mm. I think you introduced us. We did touch upon some of these things. I was making a documentary for the BBC at the time. Mm. And he said that the post-apartheid system scared people like him quite severely. You know, they really worried about what was going to happen, and were very, very pleasantly surprised by the amount of reconciliation that was possible. And he credited the leadership of people like de Klerk and Mandela, but also the kind of pragmatism that allowed people to say, right, well, we do have different histories. I certainly don't agree with yours. You certainly don't agree with mine, but we can move forward. And it was a different point of view that I had not heard from anyone else, especially involved in something as visceral as what happened in the apartheid struggle in South Africa.
I mean, the Afrikaners are kind of Africa's great survivors in a way. However controversial their past is, however, you know, deeply reprehensible a lot of it's been, this is a people that have survived, you know, being surrounded by, and one may argue for good reason, but surrounded by, you know, tribes like the Xhosa, who were, you know, bent on their destruction, who lived sort of on nothing in the desert, survived, you know, an arguably genocidal campaign at the hands of the British Army during the Boer War, and somehow managed to keep going. There's an Afrikaans expression, Boer mak 'n plan, which is a farmer makes a plan. And I think that's what a lot of Afrikaners did at the end of apartheid, was they made a plan. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we're going to somehow we'll survive. And, you know, people like Nick left the army. They saw no future for themselves in the army, and they joined private armies instead. They had a wealth of, you know, these are people who were operational. I mean, operational from 1975 through to the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And there was no NATO standard army on earth that had a similar amount of operational and combat experience as South African troops.
Mm-hmm. And hence their involvement in the type of things we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
And then just to sort of close this chapter of the book, you ended up being able to get material out, make a film of it, hopefully pay Nick, and it was judged a success. I mean, you managed to get, you know, as you say, a next rung up the ladder of a producer, director, making films.
Yeah, out of Liberia in 2002, that first trip, I made my first film for TV. You know, looking back on it, it's a bit of a dog's dinner, but I'm, you know, very proud of it in that it told a story that no one else told. Mm-hmm. And off the back of it, Nick and I were paid an incredibly small amount, I have to say. And
it's called Suffering for Art.
I think it's just called Suffering. No one in their right mind could call that art. But it led to another commission and then to another commission. So it developed a pattern of Nick and I working together. Okay. And we effectively spent the next 12 to 18 months at war in West Africa together.
Okay. And then the second part of the book is it's almost a change of pace in the book, because you have this extraordinary and extraordinarily harrowing story of the two of you, you know, falling ill, being shot at, saving, you know, et cetera, in Liberia. And then the second part of the book, it's almost like a forensic account of something that happened that you didn't know what was happening, and then you were caught up in it, and you look back and you think, goodness me, what an extraordinary adventure. And you almost set out this as a definitive account of, from your point of view, of a coup that almost took place in Equatorial Guinea. It's a very complex story. Can you give us the simple version of what happened to you and this coup?
Yes, it's as definitive as it's possible to be without being sued.
Okay, and that's another thing that we're going to be very careful about.
Yes, essentially what happened was that while we were waiting to go back to the front line outside of Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, Nick and I were having rather a lot of beers in a bar in Guinea, in Conakry. And Nick told me about a job offer that he'd been made, which was that he'd been asked to help overthrow a government in West Africa in order to install a new president who would cooperate with the oil industry, and that that country's oil reserves would then be used to pay for the mercenary operation and make the people who'd launched the operation very rich.
This is straight out of the comic book view of what white mercenaries in South Africa got up to for a couple of decades.
It's a pretty straightforward thing. And essentially, what Nick said was originally to me, it's a small place, lightly defended, fabulously rich in oil. We're going to take out the president. Classic mercenary-led seizure of power. Would you like to come along and film it?
Did he mention where this was?
No.
Okay.
Would you like to come along and film it? So I said, well, yes. I mean, obviously I would. And I said, well, is it Guinea-Bissau?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, wrong direction. Well, and that really small oil-rich countries, yes, in West Africa, it's going to be, it's either Sao Tome or it's Equatorial Guinea. There isn't really anywhere else.
Well, Gabon has quite a bit.
Gabon, you know.
Yeah, but yes, it's kind Equatorial of, Guinea know, is standing.
Yeah, it's like, it's out there. And given,
can we quickly have a picture of what Equatorial Guinea is like as a country? Just very quickly.
Well, it became very clear that the target was Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea is a small country in West Africa, which is fabulously rich in oil. The main bit of the country where the capital is an island called Bioko, which mm-hmm. sits in the Bight of Benin.
Mm-hmm.
It's just south of Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a mainland bit of the country as well, which is
tiny.
Just north of Gabon. And it's tiny, absolutely mm-hmm. tiny. And it's also Africa's third largest oil producer.
Which for a small country means that there's a lot of money coming in, but it's a fairly typical picture of what happens to the money once it comes in.
Yes, because the government of Equatorial Guinea, even by some of the worst excesses of African dictatorships, is up there at the top. It's governed by a man called President Teodoro Obiang. Obiang himself came to power in a coup in 1979, where he overthrew and then executed his own uncle. It's run as an autocratic one-party state with the financial reserves of the country going in cash straight into his pockets. It became clear in a Senate investigation in America that the Obiang family had been using the Riggs Bank in Washington to deposit very large sums of money in which they would turn up with suitcases stuffed with $100 bills. The investigation into Riggs over this eventually forced the collapse of Riggs Bank and their mm-hmm. no questions asked policy being censured. It also turned out in the process that Riggs was the bank for Augusto Pinochet and the CIA. So, and several members of the bank's staff had high level CIA clearance. So, pose a few questions about, you know, the company in which Obiang's money was being kept in. But anyway, the idea essentially was that there was an exile, a political exile to Obiang, in Spain, called Severo Moto, and that the coup plotters wanted to remove Obiang from power, either by killing or capturing him, and install Moto in his place, and that the Equatorial Guinea government would in fact then be run as an enduring business concern by the coup plotters, who would then be directly profiting themselves from Equatorial Guinea's oil revenues. So essentially what they wanted to do was not just overthrow the government, but they wanted to seize contractual control of the country and all of its assets in the way that a lot of the freebooting companies in the 19th century did on behalf of Western powers. For example, the East India Company effectively running British possessions in India on behalf of the Crown. Mm-hmm. It was a very similar model to that. Mm-hmm. It would effectively, what they wanted to do was to reduce Equatorial Guinea to a sort of vassal-like status.
Mm-hmm. So when you heard that it was Equatorial Guinea and you knew about President Obiang, that might have solved part of your conscience about whether this was a bad thing or not. But this is not exactly a model that was... It wasn't set up for the Equatorial Guinea people.
No, I mean, the government of Equatorial Guinea was and remains a brutal, violent, disgusting anachronism that has absolutely no place in the modern family of nations. You know, I mean, the average standard of living in Equatorial Guinea is you know, on a par to countries like Sierra Leone and Liberia,
mm-hmm.
Which have absolutely no oil revenue. And the average life expectancy in Equatorial Guinea is only marginally higher than it was in Liberia during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is, you know, healthcare, communications, power, lighting. I mean, it's all virtually non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
However much of a PR job the president has tried to do in recent years. So, but when I was first pitched this by Nick, it was a sort of two-stage thing, really. Firstly, I was asked, you know, we are going to do a beachhead operation, take over this country. Would you like to film it? Yes. And then he said, right, well, see, the thing is that actually what we want to do is install this new president and have him filmed surrounded only by black troops with no white faces available on camera. So it looks like he is being put into power by a spontaneous local uprising and not by a mercenary-led seizure of power.
You are crossing the line here between journalism and being the PR agency for the white mercenaries.
Yeah, essentially what he wanted to do was have me film the coup as a propaganda broadcast for the coup plotters,
mm-hmm.
to help the new regime get legitimacy and recognition, principally from Nigeria. And that in turn for agreeing to do this, I could then just sort of keep filming and eventually release my own documentary of the true story of the coup once everyone had been in place and had been given diplomatic passports and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So in this, I mean, it's a straightforward, you know, moral dilemma. On the one hand, as a journalist, it's unthinkable that I could agree to broadcast propaganda. On the other hand, Nick's offering me, I mean, the opportunity of a lifetime, mm-hmm. really. And also, it's an event that would shape the lives of tens of thousands of people on the continent. And without someone on the inside to film it, an independent voice inside, their story would just never get told.
Mm-hmm.
The story of the coup would never really have been told. So I had this sort of decision of like either like moral knee-jerk reaction to this, which I just don't do it and we never know, or I agree and somehow get the real story out eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. I agreed to go along with it and do it. But because of what happened next, for years, it wasn't possible for me to tell the true story of the coup because Nick's life was at risk.
Let's get on to that now.
And fundamentally, what this book does, the last third of this book, is, if you like, a squaring of the accounts, and it recounts as faithfully and accurately all of the details of the coup
that I'm legally able to print.
Okay. Let's have a legal and relatively brief account of what happened next.
Well, it turned out that the people who'd asked Nick to help overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea was in fact looked like a reunion of executive outcomes led by Simon Mann, former Etonian Guards officer who had been one of the leading lights behind...
And SAS officer.
Executive outcomes. He'd been an officer in G Squadron SAS for a very short period of time.
Right.
And he was putting together this operation in conjunction with other financiers and backers who wanted to overthrow the government for their own personal financial gain. There was a good deal of moral justification used in this, that they were sort of ridding the continent of a vile despot and that it was going to be great for the people of Equatorial Guinea. But fundamentally, the baseline motivation to do this, as I've said, is hard cash. A plot was put together. The personnel were brought together. The operation was launched. It failed. It was launched again. And on the second attempt, everybody involved was arrested. The vast bulk of mercenaries, 67 of them, were detained and arrested in Zimbabwe, where they were attempting to purchase weapons before flying on to Equatorial Guinea. And then a smaller group of 15, led by Nick, who were the vanguard already in Equatorial Guinea, were rounded up by the authorities there. Nick and his men were given very harsh sentences. Nick ended up serving nearly 6 years in Blackbeach Jail, one of Africa's worst, most notorious penitentiaries. And Simon Mann and the others started their sentences in Chikurubi Maximum Security Prison in Zimbabwe. Most were released after 18 months. Simon was then transferred to Equatorial Guinea and served out the remainder of his sentence there before he and Nick were both released together.
And in the meantime, you're in touch with, for instance, Nick's family, and you were trying to unpick what had gone wrong, because one thing that comes out in the book is that given how professional these guys were and their background, things didn't seem to be particularly well organised.
A friend of mine, who was recently demobbed from the SAS, described the operation as an astonishing catalogue of buffoonery, which I think is being kind. It's an absolute unmitigated farce. And I've been through this in great detail with Nick, and the reasons for the failure of this operation are legion. Mainly, it was infiltrated root and branch by South African intelligence, who, representatives of whom initially supported the coup and then were responsible for shopping it.
And you're picking your words very carefully with a lot of this.
Yeah, well, it's very clear that people who were working on behalf of the South African Secret Service told Simon that, you know, this coup was good to go, that they were supported and that they were themselves participating in it. Now, subsequently, that's been portrayed as being a sting operation that was deliberately set up to catch Simon. And that's clearly true. So South African Secret Service had infiltrated the plot at a very high level and had then made sure that it was foiled. On the other hand, we also know that senior intelligence representatives from South Africa had meetings with Severo Motto, the exiled Equato-Guinean political leader in Madrid, and had discussed with him what a post-coup Equatorial Guinea might look like. And I think initially there was quite a lot of bet hedging going on to see what might happen. And in the end, they came down very firmly against the coup. But the coup plotters were left with the impression that they were good to go. Very naively, you know, here's Simon saying to people he knows are working for the South African Secret Service, oh, this is what I'm doing, is it okay? And when they don't tell him to stop, he assumes, oh, everything must be fine. It's rather like going up to a policeman and saying, would you mind if I break this jeweller's window and steal that diamond necklace? And when the policeman doesn't say anything and you smash and grab and get arrested, you're suddenly surprised and filled with self-righteous indignation. I mean, it's completely preposterous. But on a more fundamental level, the original operation for the coup was predicated on a Congolese rebel group seizing control. Excuse me. The original plan for the coup was predicated on a group of Congolese rebels seizing control of an airstrip in Kolwezi, in Katanga, in southern Congo, where the mercenaries would then fly in, a separate plane with the weapons would fly in. They'd cross-load the weapons and men onto one aircraft, the rebels would be given some weapons as a payoff, and then the mercenaries would fly on. Mm-hmm. And that entire operation was based around one so-called rebel leader who was going to facilitate it and make it happen. Not only did that rebel army not exist,
mm-hmm.
they were an absolute invention of one man's mind. That man also turned out to be an informer for South African intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So right from the very outset, there was simply no way operationally that this could have succeeded because it was just fundamentally compromised from the outset. So I was supposed to go along and film this, and I was on 48-hour standby to get on the plane. And my grandfather, who partly raised me, was terminally ill with cancer,
mm-hmm.
gone into the final stages of his disease, and then died. And during the period of mourning, of arranging his funeral, of me being with my family, is exactly when the coup was launched. So my grandfather's death stopped me from getting on the plane,
mm-hmm.
which is why Nick went to jail and I didn't.
And Nick's now been released.
Nick was released 5 months. Nick was released 5 years and 8 months after being arrested in Equatorial Guinea.
What kind of state was he in, and what kind of state was the friendship in, given how you'd almost been caught up in what seems to have been a fairly buffoonish plot?
Yeah, I mean, when Nick was released, he'd lost 40% of his body weight. He'd been systematically tortured for years. He'd been kept bound hand and foot for almost the entire period of incarceration in jail. Originally, when he'd been shackled, the shackles had been so tight they cut down to his bone through his wrist and his ankles. He nearly died of cerebral malaria. He was kept in a 5x7 cell, tied hand and foot, in the pitch black in solitary confinement, had to eat scraps of food off the floor. So when he came out, he was he was subjected to mock executions on a daily basis for weeks by drunk prison officials. So in very bad shape physically when he came out, but apparently in very strong condition mentally. Whilst he was in jail, he went through untypical conversion to Christianity. He found God and through the Bible, which is his only reading material really, believed that he'd sort of found the way to see the error of his ways. And remains a committed Christian on being released. He's sort of very quiet about it. It's a very simple faith, but clearly one that got him through. The thing I found interesting about Nick when he was released was that he was genuinely repentant. You know, his repentance wasn't framed in sort of religious cliches. He said straightforwardly, "What we tried to do was wrong." And he's the only person involved in that whole enterprise. Not Simon Mann, not Eli Khalil, not Mark Thatcher. None of these people have stood up and said, yeah, actually, this was wrong. And Nick, I think it's very important that whatever Nick's past was, whatever he did, whatever he tried to do, fundamentally, he was able, after nearly 6 years in Africa's worst jail, to come out and say, we just got this wrong.
Mm-hmm. This story has a lot of themes that need not be African. You know, the friendship, the, you know, the slightly naive, perhaps, young reporter who gets involved in something. I'm sure that if you read, if your mother read this book before you'd actually started doing it, you would not have been anywhere near Liberia, let alone Equatorial Guinea. And then this you know, near catastrophe and redemption of your friend, as you've just described it. Is it a story that could only come out of Africa? Is it a very African setting?
I think it is, actually. I think it's a profoundly African setting in terms of the mechanics of what happens. Simply because, you know, Africa is, it's a strange place. You know, it's a wonderful, beautiful, crazy, cruel, and deeply idiosyncratic and eccentric environment to work and live in. And I think one of the defining things about this book is that Nick, a white man descended from European farming stock, is an African.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obiang is an African. Cobus Clarsons is an African. They have nowhere else to go but the continent. That's their home. And however difficult that might be for us to digest from a European point of view, but less so for you, given your long experience of living and working on the continent. It's fundamentally, you know, it's not really a story about white people and black people and about, you know, Europeans and Africans. It's a story about Africans. And, you know, even Simon was a South African citizen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a quirky story. The themes, friendship, love, redemption, of course, they're universal.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely universal. But fundamentally what happened here was that one group of Africans, led by Nick, fundamentally misunderstood another group of Africans, led by the South African Secret Service and the Ekwato Ghanaians.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened here was that Nick, Simon, the organisers, failed to appreciate the distance that the continent has travelled since their last great mercenary expedition with executive outcomes in the mid-90s, which was, by any measure, a success.
Mm-hmm.
Saved the lives of, well, probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, albeit for financial gain, but the results speak for themselves. They'd fundamentally failed to realise Africa is just a different place. And they got outfoxed, outsmarted and outwitted by a group of people that they gave no credence to at all.
Mm. I just want to go back to the journalism side. One last main question on that, and that is that journalists are often accused of portraying a rather oversimplistic picture of Africa, not really getting to grips with what the continent is about. Your contribution to this is a little bit more complex. Do you think your book, your experiences, your films that you've made about this kind of feed the stereotype or challenge the stereotype?
I hope it challenges it. Really, I mean, what I strive to do is, you know, I mean, obviously I'm recounting parts of this are brutal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is, you know, a brutal civil war. The first two-thirds of the book are taken up with, you know, executions, murders, mutilations. I mean, definitely. But they're of public interest. These are now subject to war crimes tribunal inquiries. This is evidence. It's not purient rubbernecking. This is the fundamental basis upon which, you know, international law scrutinizes international events is by journalists writing this draft of history. What I wanted to do was look at matters which were in the public interest. You know, the idea that, you know, only bad news comes out of Africa is fundamentally missing the point. You know, when did you ever hear any news broadcast that starts off with, you know, Mr. Jones, 35 Acacia Avenue, wakes up, great day, goes to work, loves his wife, it's all brilliant, comes home, kisses his kids, goes to bed, happy man. You know, great. That might be the default position for, you know, 80% of the world's population or whatever, but it's not news. Like a rebel army that's being funded by the American government that's cutting the heads off of prisoners, that's news, because somewhere in there it's going to be my tax dollars or your tax dollars. And that's important because that means as an electorate we have the capability to change things. We have the capability to hold people to account who are doing that. And if we don't know about it, we can't hold them to account. So what I wanted to do was, you know, straightforward act of journalism. It's informational. But I wanted to explore how journalism happens. Because there is this sort of pervasive myth, and it's particularly strong in America, I have to say, where this book has not been universally applauded, that, you know, somehow, according to the sort of liberal journalistic media establishment, journalists, particularly war correspondents, are supposed to be neutral, objective observers. And it's not only...
I haven't
only,
met many of those.
So not only is that a lie, it's a very pernicious and unhelpful lie. My own personal feeling is that if you are involved in the mechanics of reporting war, there will come a point at which you necessarily need to exercise your own natural and inalienable right of self-defence. And the point at which you exercise that right is the point at which you become a participant and not an observer. It's impossible to be a neutral and objective reporter of war. And that, for me, is an irrelevant sidetrack. What's important for me is to understand the paucity of objectivity, but also then to make sure that what is being presented is nonetheless credible and authentic. Mm-hmm. And it's that which is appropriate. Simply because the observer is involved in a process doesn't mean that the product is necessarily incredible or somehow not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's watching out for that that's key. I think the debate's been framed wrongly. And I, you know, this book, it's about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are people in this book who committed atrocities, rebel commanders who executed prisoners, who showed me great personal kindness and courtesy, who shared the last of their rations with me, shared the last of their cigarettes with me, talked openly and frankly about, you know, their girlfriends, their wives, their kids, their life at home, who would, you know, laugh with me and slap me on the back before shooting prisoners at point-blank range the next morning. And what I wanted to do is to try and look at some of the complexities of human behaviour that go on in war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what actually does war consist of? And it's, I think, very important to understand this is not African savagery. A generation ago, highly civilized people in Western Europe were shoveling the remains of people out of gas ovens whilst listening to opera and reading Goethe.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's what happened in the Liberian Civil War in comparison to the wars that have been fought in mainland Europe, insignificant, absolutely insignificant. What I wanted to do was explore the fact that people behave as individuals, even in the theatre of war.
Mm-hmm.
And that if people are individually accountable for their actions and can show empathy, then perhaps they are redeemable. And that's why I think it's so important that Nick expressed remorse and regret, because it shows that the journey that he's on is one fundamentally that improves him and people who participate in war as a human being.
Mm-hmm. James, I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and what impresses me is the way it's written. It it's written as something that you just want to keep turning the pages. And it almost feels as though it's got the pace of a far less serious book. But underlying this, as we've just been saying, there's all of these big themes behind, and a very, very personal experience, which we've gone into. So I can only commend you for writing the book. And I just want to end this on a traditional question. What are you working on now?
I'm currently working on a political investigation in the UK. And I'm also just beginning my next book.
Any clues?
Next book will deal with themes around belief, why people believe in things which are apparently intangible and what it causes them to do.
You're not scared of the big subjects, are you?
No. I say one of the things about my friend the mercenary, at the risk of, you know, sounding kind of a little off reservation, throughout the brutality of it and throughout the tragedy of the death and the fighting in the book and the documenting of man's inhumanity to man in the jungle in Liberia, there's another theme in there, which is something that my father's father would often talk to me about, who was a professional soldier. And he said that actually he didn't regret any of his experiences at war, because fundamentally war was the only area of sort of modern activity in which men were allowed to express unconditional love for one another. And I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at war, you know, as well as the kind of the murder and the hate and disgust. Actually, what war brings is a lot of love between people, and it expressed in ways which isn't in any other sphere of human activity. And I think that's essentially what happened between Nick and I, was that we had saved each other's lives, we'd been through a defining experience, was that was something that was very prevalent. That fundamentally, actually, as well as being able to hate each other at war, men are able to love each other too. And what my next project looks at is what happens when you invest that love in something which is intangible and ultimately destructive.
We'll keep a lookout for it, and at least then we'll perhaps understand a little bit more about what what the book is really about. But thank you, James.
Pleasure, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with James Brabazon, the author of My Friend the Mercenary. I'm Nicholas Walton, the presenter of New Books in African Studies. Have a great week.